Welcome to the Brainfluence podcast with Roger Dooley, author, speaker, and educator on neuromarketing and the psychology of persuasion. Every week, we talk with thought leaders that will help you improve your influence with factual evidence and concrete research. Introducing your host, Roger Dooley.
Welcome to the Brainfluence podcast. I'm Roger Dooley. I love firsts for guests on this show, but after more than 200 episodes, those are less frequent. We've had a Nobel Prize winner, more than 1 million selling author, an Emmy Award winner, but until today, we've never had a world poker champion. No, this show isn't about improving your poker game. It's all about the science behind improving all of your decisions. Annie Duke is a World Series of Poker bracelet winner, the winner of the 2004 Tournament of Champions, and the only woman to win the NBC National Poker Heads Up Championship. Today, she's a professional speaker and decision strategist, combining her poker expertise with her cognitive psychology graduate work at UPenn. She's the founder of How I Decide, a nonprofit that creates curriculum tools to improve decision-making and critical thinking skills for middle schoolers. I've been a fan of Annie since she was a contestant on The Apprentice and survived until the final night. I didn't know about her other interests then, but it was clear she was a smart and strategic thinker. And she has a new book out, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. Annie, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to be a first.
Yeah, well, there's still a few of those, it's great. It's really a pleasure to have you here. I have to ask you first, I mentioned The Apprentice in the intro. That was back in, 2009. Did you ever expect to see Donald Trump in the White House when you were filming that?
Well, did you expect to see Donald Trump in the White House when you were watching it? I guess I would put it back to you.
I didn't expect to see Donald Trump in the White House the night before. I was, without taking a side in the election, felt the odds were heavily against him. So did most of the pundits. We'll get into that a little bit. An example of confusing predictions and probabilities with facts. But Annie, you studied cognitive science at Penn. Did that help you as a poker player? I'm curious. Or is the academic side of things just too remote from reality?
So, it's interesting because I think that it was actually really helpful, but not for the reasons that people assumed. I think that when people heard that I studied psychology in graduate school, they were thinking about more like clinical psychology, like, you know, helping people when they're depressed or understanding when people are sad or happy or those kinds of things, where it would really be about sort of therapy and understanding those kinds of things. That is not the psychology that I studied. And as you know, it's mostly not what psychology is. It's a very small slice of it. I was studying cognitive psychology, which is really focuses on how does the brain, you know, interpret your environment as you have all sorts of stimuli coming in. How are you interpreting that? Whether that has to do with why is it that we see colors? And how does that work all the way to what my focus was on, which was how do you learn a first language? So I was really thinking about learning in these, you know, uncertain systems. How do you separate signal from noise? How do you do these sort of very hard problems of sorting out what the world has to teach you and when the world doesn't have much to teach you? And these are very thorny issues that actually transferred incredibly well to poker playing, because it's really a very similar problem.
Yeah, your brother was a very good poker player too. Is this something like, you know, you'd expect to say if LeBron James's brother turned out to be a good basketball player, you'd say, well, yeah, they got the same genes. Plus, they presumably both worked really hard and so on. But is poker, is there any natural ability to poker, or is it really primarily a learning process? And that, like, I could never play in the NBA, but could I become a champion poker player if I devoted myself to it?
So I actually think that poker and the NBA are probably a little bit more similar. You know, I think that you can teach someone to become better at basketball. And if you get them to be playing against people of the right level, right, you can get them to be winning at it. So there's lots and lots and lots of different levels at which poker occurs, all the way from very, very small stakes where, you know, you might have, you know, $50 on the table or something to very large stakes. I couldn't take a random person and make them into a world champion. I think that would be incredibly difficult because there are some sort of natural issues around, do you naturally think probabilistically how is your mind working for sort of these game theory issues? And one particular piece, which is what does your emotional control look like, right? Which I can improve, but some people naturally have better kind of control than others. Some people are naturally more probabilistic thinkers than others. The good news is, though, that I can get anybody to be better. And I think that that's true in your regular decision making, too. The goal should never be, I want to be perfect, right? I have to be world class or anything less is a failure. You should be looking at it as what, you know, if I were sort of left on my own, how good would I be? And then let me compete against that version of myself. And I think that's a nice way to think about it.
So Annie, in your new book, you start off with an example that sort of, it's a metaphor or an example that pervades much of the book, and it is a sporting event. And in the 2015 Super Bowl, Seattle was losing by 4 points with 26 seconds left in the game. It was second down. They were on their opponent, New England's 1 yard line. And for our international listeners who aren't that familiar with American football, all Seattle had to do was move the ball about a meter forward and they would almost certainly win the game. So Annie, with that set up, why don't you describe what happened?
Well, sure. So this was a really controversial play. And to this day, you know, I mean, it's a few years later, people are very enthusiastically wanting to engage on this particular play. So it created quite a bit of emotion. So here's what happens. Seattle has Marshawn Lynch, who is arguably one of the greatest running backs of all time, on their team. Their coach is Pete Carroll, who is also arguably one of the best coaches of all time. I think that that's actually not even arguable. I think both things are just, you know, agreed upon. And they have one timeout. So everybody expects that they're going to hand the ball off to Marshawn Lynch, one of the greatest running backs of all time. And Marshawn Lynch is going to plow through the New England defense to score. So that's kind of the expected play. But Pete Carroll actually calls a different play. He calls a pass. And Russell Wilson throws it to the end zone. And I think you probably recall what happened.
Yes, it was intercepted and the game went the other way. Terrible decision, right?
Well, at least according to most of the newspapers the next day. So I don't know if you recall what those headlines looked like, but I'm sure that you could imagine what the headlines looked like. I mean, it was, you know, worst call in Super Bowl history. You know, Pete Carroll botched it. I think there was one online article that actually called him an idiot. And it was really just across the board, just tearing into him for this incredibly bad decision that he had made. But I think that we need to step back from that and ask, well, was it really a bad decision or just a terrible result? Because let's just do a quick thought experiment. And I'll do this with you super fast and your listeners can take a moment to think about it. Imagine they're on the 1 yard line. Pete Carroll calls for the pass. Russell Wilson throws the ball. And it's caught. What do you think that those headlines would have looked like the next day? So, you know, Seattle wins the game on this play.
Right, sure. I mean, everybody would have acclaimed the brilliant strategy and the innovative play calling and so on, Pete Carroll.
Right. So that now all of a sudden it would have been about that. So creative. I'm imagining it would have been outsmarts Belichick, right? People would have been saying, oh, everybody expected him to hand it off to Marshawn Lynch. So how brilliant was that? That he tricked them, you know, and through the pass play. So right there, that should tell you that there's a problem with sort of the screaming headlines saying, oh, what bad decision making, because clearly the decision itself is a good decision or a bad decision independent of how it turns out. Because on one particular try, you know about as much about the decision making as you do if you flip a coin one time and it lands tails. Right. That doesn't really tell you very much about whether it's going to land tails on the next try. You've only done one try. So if we know that our sort of opinion, right, if we know that the way that we evaluate P. Carroll's decision there is going to change drastically, depending on how the play actually turns out, we know there's a problem with the way that we're evaluating the decision. And we're falling prey to a trap that poker players call resulting, which is assuming that the result of a decision, the quality of the result, tells you everything you need to know about the quality of the decision. But we know that can't possibly be true. I mean, I'll just ask you this question. Have you ever accidentally run through a red light in your life?
Sure.
Sure. Did you get in a car accident every single time that happened?
Never.
Never. So do you think, though, that going through red lights is a good decision?
No, it's not.
No. Right. Because they're disconnected, right? We know there's a lot of luck in the way that it turns out. So instead, what we want to do is say, we know that there's luck in the way it turns out. Let's actually look at what percentage of the time, for example, balls were intercepted in that situation for Seattle, sort of over the course of enough times that play has been called, or across the NFL, right? So we have some idea of what the actual percentages are. And it turns out that the percentage of time that the ball is intercepted in that particular spot was about 1%. So Pete Carroll had a 1% thing happen. It was incredibly unlucky. And most of the time, actually, the ball is actually either going to be caught or just dropped, right? And if it's dropped, nobody's going to say anything about it either, because they're just going to hand it off to Marshawn Lynch on the next play. So if people want to look at, if anyone's interested in looking at a really deep analysis of the kind of math of that decision, certainly go read my book, Thinking in Bets. But also you can go look at some source material that I use, which is Benjamin Morris on 538.com did a really beautiful analysis of this play. Now, really, after you read this analysis, you may agree or disagree with the math of it, or whether strategically it was good, or whether Belichick could have anticipated this or whatever. But I think that we can agree that there's a discussion to be had, that these complete, you know, sort of declaring with certainty that this was the worst play in Super Bowl history, that we can agree, well, given that you can actually have a really deep discussion about the quality of that decision, coming up with worst play in Super Bowl history is probably unreasonable.
Right. And the key factor there is that about a 1% chance that it would go horribly wrong. And that's a reasonable bet in most circumstances. And as you say, that's really sort of the lens that we view all of our decisions through. And I even wonder if Pete Carroll found himself a year later in the exact same situation, if he wouldn't have said, well, I think I'll run the ball this time, as opposed to, you know, to making the worst play twice in a row.
So I would actually argue that one of the things that makes Pete Carroll such a great coach is that if he were in that situation again, that he would pass the ball again.
Yeah, I'll make the same call.
Right. So I think that we actually have a really good clue to that. He gave an interview to Good Morning America, and he was asked about the play. And he said, he chose his words very carefully. He said something, I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, but it was something like this. Yes, I agree. It was the worst result of a play in Super Bowl history. So he chose his words very carefully. And the thing is that one thing that great decision makers are really good at is looking at the outcome of a decision, right? Just the way that things turned out, what is the result? And not just because the result is bad, going in and changing their decision quality, or just because the result is good, breaking their arm to pat themselves on the back and reinforcing the decision. They're actually much better at saying those two things are only loosely correlated, and let me kind of separate these things out a little bit and evaluate the decision quality independent of its result, you know, as much as possible. Now, obviously, if you have lots and lots and lots and lots of results, you can start to say that the result is signaling something about the quality of the decision. Just like if I flip a coin 10,000 times, you know, I can say a lot about the coin. And that's actually kind of the point with the Pete Carroll decision, is that we do have lots of data on how passes turn out in that situation. And that's how we know that they get intercepted about 1% of the time. And that's actually the much better information than the way it turned out on this time. And Pete Carroll's really good at making that separation. It's why he's such a good coach. It's why he's such a good decision maker. And we should all take that lesson from him.
Yeah, and I would guess, too, that his opponent in that game, Bill Belichick, who's also a legendary coach, seems to be a pretty unemotional, rational kind of coach. You know, I think part of the reason for the criticism is not that it was unexpected. And I think that happens in other venues too. For example, for years in the earlier days of computing, there was a saying that nobody got fired for buying IBM. And it was really that same kind of decision. Now, if you said, hey, this other company has a better, more expensive or less expensive product that I think is going to work well in our situation, and you made that decision and it turned out wrong, that the project failed, the decision maker would get the blame because it was sort of the unexpected call. But if you bought IBM and it turned out badly, well, hey, they're IBM. You know, it's they screwed up.
So I agree with you. And I think that this really comes down to a leadership issue, right? I think that because we do this thing called resulting, and we do use outcome quality as a really good signal for decision quality, and our employees know that, right? The people that we're leading know that. What happens is that you'll see people kind of putting up shields to kind of fend this off, right? So particularly in cases where you're going against the grain, it becomes problematic for you as a company because you're actually molding the decision making of the people around you to defend against resulting. And it's exactly what you just said, right? If they go with the safe choice and it doesn't work out, everybody's sort of like, yeah, well, I would have made that decision too because it was the safe choice. If they go with the unexpected choice and it doesn't work out, all of a sudden the decision making gets blamed because people are using that as the signal. So what happens is that going sort of with the safer choice becomes a way to shield yourself from people who are evaluating you using resulting as the heuristic. And that's really bad for you because what you're going to do is lose innovation, right? That's really the big problem. And, you know, you can see this also like even just in hiring decisions, right? Going with the guy with the really long resume, you know, who maybe didn't interview so well, but on paper, it's really easy to justify it, even if it doesn't work out. Versus going with someone who maybe looks a little bit more out of the box, you know, has interviewed really well, you think would bring innovation, you know, to the company, is a less obvious choice, you know, and you go with the obvious choice because it defends you against resulting. And it's something that we really need to think about as leaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is really one important lesson in the book, Annie, that, you know, it's so natural for us to equate the result with the decision. But I mean, there's obviously a relationship. You really have to go back and look if you have a bad outcome and say, okay, well, at the time, was that the most reasonable decision without also some hindsight bias? Because I'm sure that kicks in
it
too.
Does. It seems inevitable.
Right. Improbable choice. Well, gee, you know, we knew that was a bad decision.
Right. So one thing that I recommend to people in terms of trying to really deal with this problem, because it really is just a very basic part of the way that our cognition works, is as much as possible, evaluate decisions prior to the outcome. So like in your example, get together in a strategy group to talk about, you know, are you going to buy IBM? Are you going to buy the more out of the box choice? And really walk through the decision-making process so that people, including the leadership, are signing up off on those kinds of decisions with an agreement that we all recognize that these outcomes could occur. So as much as you can do that, you know, and this would be true, like if you're a trial lawyer, evaluate your trial strategy as much as you can before the verdict comes in. If you're running a sales strategy, evaluate the tactics and the overall strategy that you're applying, you know, as much as you can prior to getting an answer, sort of closing out the sales cycle. So, you know, you can imagine you can apply this in a lot of different places. And then the other thing that I would say is if you do have an outcome already, try to make sure that you're getting in front of some sort of strategic group that doesn't know the outcome and walk through the decision process with them and don't tell them how it turned out. And we can imagine, like in the Pete Carroll example, if I just walk through the math of it and I don't tell you whether it was caught or not, you're going to have a much different view in evaluating that decision process than if you do know how it turned out.
Right. Of course, I think we expect from both coaches and executives some sort of supernatural power that not understand the odds and then make the right choice, make the choice that's going to prove to be correct regardless. How do we deal with imperfect knowledge? I mean, that's part of the title of the book and much of the theme of the book. Most decisions are made when we don't have all the facts. We can't even assign neat probabilities.
Yeah. So I think that there's a couple of things. The first thing is, get comfortable with uncertainty. So I think one of the problems that we have as decision makers is that we think that we need to be certain in order to make a decision, but that's actually incredibly unrealistic. It's not a good representation of the world because, for example, even in the Pete Carroll case, or in your case of do you buy IBM or do you buy a competitor or do you drive through the red light or don't you? Whenever you make a decision, there's always going to be some set of possible futures that can occur. And we can't be certain about what those futures might be. So number one, if you get comfortable with uncertainty, you're going to have a much more accurate representation of the world, which is necessarily going to help you make better decisions. Two, counterintuitively, it helps you deal with decision paralysis. Because when you feel like you have to get to certainty, well, it's kind of an unrealistic goal. So one of two things will happen. Either you'll pretend that you're certain or you'll convince yourself you're certain you're not when you're not, or you'll be on that never-ending quest to keep getting more and more and more and more information to try to attain that level that you think that you need to get to. When you realize, no, I just need to gather the information that I need and figure out what the possible futures are and then compare the decisions under consideration to try to make a stab at what's going to have the highest probability of resulting in the best outcome. And then you know that you're going to really work hard to disconnect outcome from decisions. So you're going to do a lot less of I told you so. So you're kind of worried much less about what happens on the back end because you're so committed to the decision process. You're just going to do a lot better and you're going to be actually much more decisive. So that's number one. Number two is if we do have this problem where we don't have all the facts by definition, right? I don't know everything that you know. I mean, that's just a fact. I don't view the world in exactly the same way you do. The hypotheses that I can come up with are just necessarily different than yours, right? So we all know that we're walking around with imperfect information, even for something that seems like we have very good information. So if I went back to, say, the traffic light example, let's say that my car is in good working order, road conditions are good, I am totally sober, I am following the speed limit, and I'm, you know, looking both ways and checking out all the traffic and, you know, so on and so forth, and I go through a green light. Obviously, the highest probability result is that I get through that light just fine. But the thing I don't know is, what are the cars that are behind me going to do? What are the cars that are coming from the other part of the intersection going to do? Right. So I can get in an accident despite the fact that I've done everything right. And it feels like a very certain decision, but it's actually not. So we should just sort of get used to that. So that's that piece. So in terms of the imperfect information piece, become a really good information gatherer. And the way that you do that is really, I'll give you two ways. There's lots and lots of ways in the book, but make sure. So I'll give you two. Number one, make sure that you're inviting people to give you information. And one of the ways you can invite people to give you information is by expressing yourself in a way that really opens the door. So I think that most of us walk around and we confuse confidence with certainty. Being a confident decision maker, I think in most of our minds, is conflated with saying, I know this and I'm 100% sure of it. I know this to be true. Believe me, it's true. Believe me, right? And that this is what we think of as being a confident decision maker. But actually, and I would sort of take the analogy from poker, there's a difference between acknowledging uncertainty and understanding, well, I'll never have all the information. And of course, I can't perfectly predict the future, and still being confident in your decision making that you have a better decision maker than your competitors. So you can be confident in your decision making process and still acknowledge uncertainty. In fact, it can help you to gain confidence in your decision-making process, because if you're better at handling uncertainty and acknowledging it and wrapping it into your decision-making process than your competitors are, then you will be a better decision-maker than they are. So you can be confident. So what's really helpful is if when we're expressing our opinions and our beliefs and our predictions to other people, we take a stab at letting them know how certain we are on a scale of, you know, 0 to 10. You know, how sure are you of your belief? On a scale of 0 to 10, how sure are you of your prediction about the future? Or if you're comfortable with it, what's your percentage on that? I think that I'm going to be happier if I order the chicken or the fish, and I'm 80% that I think the chicken is going to make me happier, right? I'm not 100% because I don't know. The chicken could be overcooked. I could regret it, but I'm 80% on it. Now, we can do this in all sorts of ways. I really believe that this strategy is going to work. And I've sort of thought about it in comparison to other strategies. And I've decided that all the other strategies, you know, are total up 40%. And I think 60% of the time we're going to do better with this strategy. That's how confident I am in that. So now what happens when you express things that way is you open the door for other people to share their opinions, to share their beliefs, and to share relevant information with you. Why? Well, we can think about it really simply. If you, particularly you as a leader, announce something that you're 100% on, you shut down people in the room sharing with you for one of two reasons, generally. Reason number one is that you have said it with such certainty, whatever information they have that might moderate your opinion, that might moderate your belief, they actually think is wrong, right? So I say, like, for something silly, like Citizen Kane won Best Picture. You thought it was a different movie, but now you don't say it because you're like, wow, Annie's really sure of it. So I'm not going to express my opinion because I don't want to embarrass myself in front of Annie and say that I believe this other thing. So you keep your mouth shut. So that's bad for me. Or the other thing is particularly, again, problematic if you're a leader, is I announce it with total certainty and you don't want to embarrass the boss. So even though you're pretty sure that I'm not right, you don't tell me the information that you have for fear of embarrassing me or for fear of not being seen as a team player or for fear of whatever it's causing you to keep your mouth shut that is related to me, not to you. And that's really, really bad for me as a leader. It's bad for me, for my company, that I'm not opening the door really wide for people to be able to share this information. Now, if I say instead something like, you know, Citizen Kane won Best Picture, but I'm 60% on that. Now the door is wide open. If you say that you disagree, you're not wrong because I never said I was right. You're not embarrassing me because I was requesting. I was saying, hey, I'm only 60% on this, so please share.
You know, I think that thinking in percentages is a huge takeaway from the book. It obviously relates to various kinds of games, but in real life, everything is so often binary. I mean, we talked about the last year's presidential election and just about every pundit predicted that Hillary was going to win. Nate Silver was probably the most visible one. And his probabilities were somewhere in the, 60 or 70% range that Hillary was going to win. But what everybody saw in looking at that prediction was Hillary's going to win. That they didn't see it as, hey, Hillary's probably about, you know, a couple times as likely to win as the other guy, but it's, we tend to think that way. And even in our own internal decision-making process, I can certainly see how one person expressing an apparently firm opinion can influence people around him or her. But just even in our own mind, if we think of things in probabilities, we're likely to have a more clear and effective decision-making process.
Yeah. So I think actually the presidential election is such a great example of this, right? So Nate Silver, who does think probabilistically, it was bouncing around, but it was between 60-40 and 70-30, right? So he's got it somewhere between 60% of the time and 70% of the time Clinton wins this election. Now, if you really wrap your head around that, right, that makes it actually not that unlikely that Trump is going to win. Let's take the lower end, right? 60%. That means 40% of the time Trump is going to win. I mean, would you bet your life if I had a coin that was, you know, 60% of the time heads and 40% of the time tails, like, would you bet your life on betting on heads, even though it's 60%? I imagine no. So, because we really understand like 40% is a lot, right? So, but what happens is that because people are seeking certainty, and this is particularly true in punditry, right, where people want to make pronouncements, right? They want to say, like, I know this for sure.
Well, yeah, if you're on a news show and all you answer with very nuanced answers, you won't get invited
exactly.
back.
Exactly, and this is a big problem because what did the pundits do? They took Nate Silver's data and they did exactly what you pointed out, right? Which is they said Hillary Clinton's going to win. So now what happens the next day, right? So now it's November 9th, 2016, and Trump has won. And what did the headline scream? It was very Pete Carroll-like. You were wrong. And when you listen to Trump speak, you hear him say this all the time. You know, everybody was wrong. You know, they said Trump wasn't going to win the election. They were wrong. So therefore, we shouldn't listen to the pollsters. And what I would say is, no, actually, we should listen to the pollsters because they seem to have it pretty good. We shouldn't listen to the pundits who are trying to take what the pollsters are saying and turn it into right or wrong, black and white, yes or no, absolute certainty. Because otherwise what you get is this is an explosion of, you know, you were wrong and now, you know, I'm going to discount you. So I think that that is actually such a beautiful example of the problem with misrepresenting the state of the world as certain when it's not, because I actually wasn't that surprised on November 9th.
Well, there were certainly some people who weren't completely surprised, but you somehow always expect, even in a game of chance, you know, if you're playing blackjack and you've got a 20, you expect to win. And of course, the dealer always ends up with 21, but at that point, you're just about counting your winnings because, you know, it's a pretty high probability.
Right. So you just always kind of want to hold that in mind. And to that point, I think that when you do that and you really kind of memorialize the decision process, right, prior to the outcome. So you're working out the decision process and you lay out and you know, you can put it on a whiteboard and just take a picture of it and then make sure that it's there for people to see after the fact, right? You're doing some sort of strategic planning, you're thinking about what the scenarios are, you get people in the room to make a stab at assigning probabilities to the scenarios. People are scared to do this, by the way, because they're like, well, I don't know what the probability is. And what I say to them, well, is I know that the scenario is not 0% or 100%. And I know that you've been doing what you're doing for a long time. So yes, I understand that it's not going to be perfect, but it's going to be a lot better than defaulting to 0 or 100. So just take a stab at it. Give me a range of how often you think that this might happen, understanding that it's going to be imperfect, but it's going to be a lot better than the default, right? So that's sort of one way to do it. So now you figure out, here are these scenarios, here's how often they're going to happen, and then memorialize that so that when the unexpected thing happens, when it doesn't go your way, you don't immediately have that, we should have known, our decision was bad, we were wrong. Because now you start making adjustments to your strategy that you actually shouldn't necessarily, because that scenario was already in your view. So to the blackjack example, you know, I have a 20, you know, let's say the dealer has a 6, there's some percentage of the time that I'm going to win that and some that I'm not. So what the result is, what actually ends up happening, is irrelevant to whether a 20 should have won, or, you know, is mostly going to win or not. Same thing with Pete Carroll, right? If you had that, if everybody saw at the time, oh, he's calling a pass play, and before the result, they said 1% of the time it will get intercepted, right? So you knew that, and you now memorialized it, and then it gets intercepted. Now you start to evaluate that result in a very different light. That's the difference between looking at the data that Nate Silver is giving or listening to a pundit on TV.
Right. Well, I think that's great advice that I'd say in most business decision-making processes is rarely followed. You know, first of all, you assign probabilities, but then also record the thought process in some way so that it doesn't become a blame game later on, or just where people are beating themselves up for making the wrong decision. You know, I think that if you made the best decision you could at the time based on the information you had, then you'll apparently live to fight another day. One last question, Annie. You talk about mental time travel. Now, what do you mean by that? I thought that was an interesting section of the book.
Well, so I feel like a lot of people are Seinfeld fans, and I have to imagine that for your international audience, Seinfeld is pretty well syndicated in other countries. I'm just guessing. But there's a very famous bit that Jerry Seinfeld does, which is very funny, where he's talking about Night Jerry and Morning Jerry. And it basically goes something like this, you know, Night Jerry, he's such a jerk because Night Jerry's having fun and he doesn't want to go to bed. And even though he should go to bed, he stays up and he keeps drinking and he's, you know, so on and so forth. And then he goes to bed really, really, really late. And then Morning Jerry wakes up and he's, curse you, Night Jerry, because Morning Jerry, of course, is like super tired because Morning Jerry didn't get enough sleep. And I think that this bit from Seinfeld is obviously really funny. I recommend people go look up it up on YouTube because it really is hilarious. But it's so insightful, right? That ultimately Morning Jerry and Night Jerry are the same person. But in that moment of deciding when to go to bed, for Night Jerry, Morning Jerry doesn't even exist, right? So then Morning Jerry is like, hey, jerk, you weren't thinking about me when you were making your decisions. And the fact is, it's true. So what we want to do is try to leverage mental time travel in some way so that we can get Morning Jerry to somehow tap Night Jerry on the shoulder and say, hey, I'm going to exist. Could you please go to bed and take care of me? And there are a variety of ways to do this. One of the ways that I mentioned in the book, and there's a whole chapter devoted to this, so hopefully people will dive into that, but one of the ways that I talk about, which is a really simple way, is through a Ulysses contract. So there's ways that we can sit when we're in a very rational state of mind and anticipate when we might have difficulty in decision making. So a very simple example, if we take sort of this Night Jerry kind of problem, is to think about, well, if I'm going out with friends on a Saturday night and I know that there's going to be, you know, wine and drinks involved or whatever, I recognize that version of me may not be the most rational decision maker about whether I should say get in a car and drive home, right? So what's the solution? You put in what's called a Ulysses contract, which is to somehow bind the hands of future you from acting on your most irrational impulses. So in this case, you could, for example, take a ride sharing service to the bar, or in the old days, you would have, you know, a designated driver. And these were Ulysses contracts. So Ulysses contracts come from the Odyssey. Ulysses was the Roman name for Odysseus. And as people might recall, Odysseus, you know, traveling home to Penelope, he's got all sorts of trials along the way. One of them is that he has to sail past the island of the Sirens. And the Sirens sing this song that is so irresistible to the ears of man that anybody who sails by the island will steer their boat into the shore toward the Sirens to get to their song. And the shore is rocky and it will break the ship apart and put the sailors to their assured death. So what does Odysseus do? Well, he knows that he's going to have this trial ahead of him. And he knows that as he's sailing by the Sirens island, he will not be rational in his decision making and he will sail toward the shore. So he puts wax in the ears of his crew so that they can't hear the song. And then he does want to hear the song. So he asks the sailors to bind his hands to the mast. And that no matter what he does, no matter what signals he makes, no matter what it is, that they are not allowed to untie his hands. And they do this, and he gets by the island of the Sirens intact. So if we think about something as simple as a ride-sharing service, that's a very good example of a Ulysses contract. And it's one of the most basic time-traveling exercises that we can do in order to improve our decision-making. Basically, what happens is that past Ulysses has bound present Ulysses' hands to the mast to stop him from acting. That's exactly what we want. That's morning Jerry and night Jerry having a little conversation.
Yeah, you know, that makes me think of a strategy, Annie, that if any of our listeners are just tuning in for the first time in this podcast, they could create their own little Ulysses contract by subscribing through iTunes or whatever the player of their choice is, and then the podcast future editions would automatically appear there for them to listen to. Not a binding contract, but more of a nudge, perhaps.
So that's actually a very good example of Ulysses contract, because Ulysses contracts don't have to be binding. They can, and they don't necessarily have to be places where you raise barriers. They can be places where you lower barriers as well. Because most of the time, we can't actually physically bind our hand to the mast. An example I would give you is if you have determined to eat healthy in your life and you throw all the junk food out of your house, it doesn't mean that at midnight you can't actually get in your car and drive to, you know, a 7-Eleven and go get yourself a, you know, microwave burrito. You can do that. So that would be a barrier, but not one that's binding you. It just creates, first of all, it makes it more difficult for you to execute on it. But the other thing it does, which I think is really important, is it creates a stop and think moment that pulls you out of the moment where you can sort of take a moment to think about your overall goals and imagine how you feel, how you might feel about driving and eating this burrito when you have determined to eat healthy. And so it gives you an opportunity to take the mindlessness out of your decisions. Instead of just sort of mindlessly grabbing for the pint of ice cream in the fridge, you have a stop and think moment that's created because you've put some barrier up. But sometimes it's barrier reducing, which is what I would say, subscribe to the podcast in the future, because that just reduces the barrier to you remembering to actually listen to the podcast. And an example of that would be, I've decided to eat healthy, but I recognize that a lot of times when I'm on the go, it's hard for me to do that. So I'm going to bring a bag with me that has all sorts of healthy snacks in it. And that just makes it easier for me to now stick to my goal. And that also is really a Ulysses contract. It's me thinking about Annie in the future and the difficulties that I might have in terms of making decisions that actually propel me toward a goal that I have, and making sure that either making it harder for me to mess up or easier for me to follow.
That's great. Probably a good place to wrap it up. I'll remind our listeners that our guest today is Annie Duke, poker champion, decision-making expert, and author of the new book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. Annie, how can our listeners find you and your ideas online?
Sure. So I'm very active on Twitter and I post a lot of content on there. The other thing that I've just started doing about 2 months ago, maybe 2.5 months ago, I'm very excited about it, is I do a weekly newsletter that will hit your inboxes every Friday. And I really look mostly at current events through this decision-making and critical thinking lens. So for example, the discussion that we had that was, I loved it. And I was so happy that you brought it up about how do you interpret the election results, for example, and the polling around it and the pundits versus the pollsters. That's exactly the kind of content that would be in the newsletter, very similar to the content that's in the book. And I send that out every Friday. So if people are interested in subscribing to that and having that hit their inboxes, they can go to annieduke.com and they can find a place to sign up for the newsletter there. That is also where you can find me to hire me. So if you want to hire me, I do keynoting, I do corporate retreats, and I do deep dive corporate consulting, both on general culture around promoting good decision making and a healthy decision making organization, and then also around specific decisions when people are doing strategic planning. So you can find me at annieduke.com for that as well.
Great. And is your Twitter handle at annieduke, I assume?
That's true. I should say that when I say go find me on Twitter. It is. It's at annieduke. And like I say, I'm very active on there, and it's me posting.
Great. Well, we will link to those places, to Annie's book, and any other resources we talked about on the show notes page at rogerdooley.com/podcast. Annie, thanks for being on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a really fun conversation.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Brain Fluence Podcast. To continue the discussion and to find your own path to brainy success, please visit us at rogerdooley.com.